Okay, check one, two, check one, two, check one, two. Da-da-da. Sure that we still have levels. We do. Except my VU meter's not really working, so. I hope we have levels.
I hope we have.
Half an hour later, Kate, would you mind just repeating everything you've been saying for the last half hour? So, anyway, well, I guess to begin with, I mean, I've spoken to a number of different gender activists, and I get different perceptions of gender from everyone, from the notion that it's a continuum to the idea that it just doesn't exist at all. So I guess, is there sort of one sort of overriding perception of gender that you operate with?
Yeah, I think gender is very real in the culture. It exists. I mean, it would be foolish to think not. Look how much oppression occurs in its name. Look how much power is acquired in its name and denied in its name. So gender exists, but it exists, I think, as a social construct in the same way that astrological signs exist, you know? I mean, you know, someone's a Pisces, but if they don't believe in that, then, you know, they say, no, I'm not. You know, just because I was born in March, it makes me a Pisces? Now, I happen to believe in astrology, so yeah, I'll buy into it. But there's all kinds of ways to treat gender. You can treat it as holy, you can treat it as essential, you can treat it as don't mess with it. You can treat it as a playground. I treat it as the latter.
So what do you say to people who say, well, but gender is a biological reality? You know, there's two sexes. They have different genitalia. They have different chromosomes. They have different hormones. And, you know, that's just proof positive that this is not a playground. It's it's a biological reality.
Well, I would say first off that I don't use the word sex to apply to any concept that implies categorization. By saying there's gender, and some people say this, they say, well, gender's between your ears and sex is between your legs. No, I don't buy that, because by saying sex is a way to categorize people implies that biology has the final word on who and what we are, and I don't think it is. I don't think biology is destiny. I don't think identity is destiny, for that matter. So if someone says, well, there are only two sexes, I say, well, you mean there are only two biological genders? And maybe they'll buy that. And they'll say, yeah, there are only two biological genders. I say, well, what are you basing it on? And they'll say, chromosomes. And I'll say, you mean XX and XY? And they'll say, yes. And I'll say, well, there's a lot more than XX and XY. There's XXX, XYY, YYX, XO. There's like 14 to 20 different combinations in there. Are there 14 to 20 different genders? Well, they say, well, no, then it's hormones. I said, oh, okay, well, what ratio of testosterone and estrogen are you talking about? Because we all have different ratios. We all have both of them. We all have different ratios. Do you happen to know the ratio of your hormonal content, right?
Yes, sometimes.
And you don't even know your chromosomes, for that matter. Well, they say, well, it's genitalia. That's what it boils down to. I see. Okay. Well, how big? How long? How deep? How wide? How wet? You know, like, is there a perfect set of genitals, or are we saying there's a range of genitalia? What about intersexed people? And that's a healthy percentage of the population. I mean, you're talking 5 to 10% of the population is born with anomalous genitalia. You can't ignore that. And I'll say anomalous because, you know, where do you draw the line on someone having, like, a 2-inch penis? Is that anomalous genitalia? How about a 12-inch penis? How about, you know, a vagina with three sets of lips? I mean, you know, what are we talking about? There is no classification biologically into two and two only.
What about people who say, you know, historically there has always been a fairly consistent division of labor between men and women, and that that is somehow indicative of the fact that there are only two genders?
I would say it's more indicative of the fact that we have historically been a species that has existed on bipolar thought processes. And we have in the past divided everything into two. you know? There's two kinds of people in the world, the kind of people who believe there are two kinds of people and the kind that don't. You know, it's like we always divide things into two. And, well, of course, why not humanity? But I think we're getting beyond that. I think, you know, yes, that's part of our history. I mean, part of our history was also that, you know, we would go around in animal skins and, you know, slug it out with each other and, you know, rape whatever we could or be raped by whatever we could be raped by. You know, that's part of our history. Does that mean we got to continue doing that? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. So what's your take on the whole notion of gender-specific behavior? Do you think that it is at all biologically influenced, or do you think that men are socialized to be more aggressive, so to speak, and women are socialized to be more passive, so to speak, or how do you view that?
Well, I think it's got to be a combination. I would say there, sure, there are biological factors in gender-specific behavior. But again, it's not a clear-cut line. I mean, you're saying, well, a man's going to act this way in a given situation and a woman's going to act that way. It's like the men are from Mars, women are from Venus thing. Is that the most ridiculous book ever? Me, I'm from Uranus. It's like, it doesn't work that way. You know, like Woody Allen is not going to react the same way as Arnold Schwarzenegger. Madonna is not going to react the same way as Mother Teresa. There are lots of different ways. Or Lucy Lawless, I mean, you know, for that matter. In astrology, we're told that a Pisces is this way, a Taurus is this way, and that's the way it is. But many astrologers don't view it that way. They say, well, these are some challenges you have to face, and these are some inclinations that you'll have, but everybody's got the capacity for everything. And I think that's the point we need to start taking with gender, that everybody has the capacity to be aggressive or nurturing or passive or hunter-gatherers, whatever. Everybody has that capacity. And it's only, I think, our tendency and habit of bipolar thinking processes that have landed us into, well, that's the way it is. I hate it when someone tells me that's the way it is about anything, you know? I mean, it's the same thing. That's the way it is. Everybody's heterosexual. People believe that. People believe that's the way it is. Whites are good. Blacks are bad. People believed that and for centuries acted on that. Does that make it right? We're just now facing gender as a previous, you know, holy cow of the culture in the same way that race was approached, in the same way that sexuality was approached. We're questioning it, those of us who've kind of been through the gender wars. But feminists have been questioning it for thousands of years, saying biology is not destiny, and ain't I a woman? And everybody raised their eyebrows at that.
Do you think that if children were raised in a bubble without any sort of outside influence from society, that they would grow up to be much more androgynous in looks and behavior?
Boy, oh boy. You know, science went down that road when they started conducting experiments in a vacuum and trying to predict behavior of physical phenomena based on what happened in a vacuum. But vacuums just don't exist in most spaces. Chaos theory has a big... I'm going to get to your question, I swear. Chaos theory has a bearing on this. Chaos theory says it's all interconnected. You can't say that an experiment conducted in a vacuum is going to work inevitably, because if you take it out onto a field, there's going to be a gust of wind. So everything being connected... no, I can't even conceive of a child being raised in a bubble or a vacuum or any way like that. And people ask me, well, how do I raise my child to be genderless? And there's only one answer. Be genderless yourself. Provide the example. Children, you know, it's monkey see, monkey do. When we're children, we are really, really dependent on our parents. And if we see our parents acting in a gender-specific behavior, that's what we're going to go for.
So I was really intrigued to learn that you watch Star Trek. Because when I think about a genderless planet or you know, a world where, yeah, I guess, you know, a world where people behave in a genderless fashion. I think of that episode where they land on the genderless planet. And I'm just wondering how you, I mean, you know, obviously we don't have much hope of living in a perfect world, but how you perceive a perfect world to be.
Well, now this was funny because...
Would it be anything like Star Trek?
I hope not. The Genii, which is the people
she
who populate...
The name.
Of course, I am more than a watcher of Star Trek. I am a confirmed Trekker. I own a Star Trek uniform. And I know. The Star Trek episode that talked about the gender-free planet actually went to a dystopic version of no gender. They were as rabid about having no gender as we are about having one. And, you know, that's just a projection of how rabid we are about having a gender. And we are, most of us. We're very rabid about, you know, I am a man, I am a woman. How dare you question that? But the world I would envision would be much more playful. I mean, everybody in that world was dressed in gray or brown.
Mm-hmm.
Ew. I mean, you know, what happened to fashion? Hello. I think that, you know, like the world I would envision would be totally free of gender and free to play with gender.
Mm-hmm.
And so there would be a multiplicity of genders, not just two.
So would categorization of gender exist at all?
I would hope not, except on a minute-to-minute basis. You know, like, again, I'll use the astrology metaphor. I mean, okay, I'm a Pisces, but I have a Taurus moon, you know, so that's going to affect it. You know, I've got four planets in Leo. That's going to affect the way I am, too. And depending on my mood, you might see the Leo side of me. You might see the mood, you know, the Taurus side of me. I dig my feet in sometimes. And I'm very stubborn sometimes, which is very un-Pisces-like. In the same way as gender, why do we need a categorization? Of what value is it? That's my question.
Well, I was just going to ask you, like, do you believe that there's ever any need to segregate people based on some of the characteristics that we currently attribute to gender? Like, I mean, for example, Olympic events.
I think in a sick world, which is what we live in, yes, there's a need for segregation by category, by identity, only for healing purposes. It's why I support the existence of women-only space and why I don't go in there. Because I think it's an important healing phase in the development of a community. It's got to gather enough strength into itself to be strong enough to be fluid. And a fluid identity, be it personal or organizational, I think is what we need to be aiming for.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to the Olympic example then, what do you do? I mean, given that there are differences in body structure and body type and body strength, how do you make it fair?
Well, let's say we've got Olympic shot putting, okay? Would you put Woody Allen on the men's team or the women's team? Yeah. Or would you put Danny DeVito? You can't
they don't
say...
don't compete in Olympic events.
No, they don't compete in Olympic events, but you're talking, there's a man, but there are, you know, literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of women who are stronger and more capable at that sport than they are. I haven't really looked at the nature of competition. Mariah Nelson Burton, I'll have to get this for you. I'm sorry. Oh my God, she's going to hate me. Is writing a great deal about the subject of sports and competition and gender. And her work is fascinating because she really explores that. I would recommend you interview her. I'll get you her email address. Yeah.
Well, what about, I mean, some of the other sticking points, like washrooms, for example? I mean, do you think ultimately they should be desegregated?
Ultimately, yes. But I think it's going to have to be a phase-over operation for the same reason that we are living in a sick society. and there are rapists out there, and there are people who are going to take advantage of that situation. So I think there needs to be developed a phase over. And Martine Rothblatt, in her book, The Apartheid of Sex, she calls it sex, it's her word, not mine. Martine Rothblatt calls for two main actions that would, you know, start to knock out the underpinnings of the grip that gender, the bipolar gender system has on the culture. She says, number one, we have to get rid of the what gender are you question on all questionnaires and government forms and insurance policies and everything. And number two, we have to get rid of segregated washrooms. I mean, people, you have to remember, we're only 100 years away from a time, if that much. We're only like, actually, we're only 50, 60, 40 years away from a time when there were segregated washrooms according to race, and people thought that was natural. There were water fountains, you know, whites and coloreds. People thought that was totally natural and appropriate and the way it should be and the way God created it. Otherwise, why would God have created two different races? Yeah, we got to get over ourselves. I mean, what's the big deal? I mean, who isn't pee shy? I mean, get over it.
How do you think we desegregate things like washrooms and locker rooms without causing panic in the meantime?
Happens all the time. You walk through Europe and there are desegregated bathrooms, for goodness sake. It's going on right now. I think it's our own insular North American point of view that we have to have everything separated out neatly and you know, anally separated, literally.
What do you think it is that makes people feel so uncomfortable about, like, sharing, having, like, men and women, so to speak, in the same locker room, changing in front of each other, or bathrooms, or whatever?
Socialization, and, you know, and perhaps some bad experiences. You know, I freak out, and, you know, I'm not exempting myself from this. I would have to get over it, too. You know, like, you go to an all-women's event in a bar, let's say, and the bathroom's crowded, and you go, heck with it, honey, it's the men's room, you know? And you walk in, and there's urinals, there's this, uh-oh, you know? And, you know, like, you go to, like, queer events, and there's, you know, like, these wonderful, glorious drag queens, you know, in the women's bathroom. So, that's great. And, you know, they're the drag kings in the men's bathroom. That's great. You know, I think what we're afraid of is we've learned that so much violence occurs because of gender, and particularly because of gender ambiguity, that our only solution has been, well, it's got to be black or white, we've got to segregate it, rather than learning to evolve as a human race into the acceptance of fluidity, which is, I think, where we're headed and where we've got to head.
Do you think it also has to do a bit with the preoccupation, or the sort of Christian preoccupation with, like, sex and purity and keeping people away from the objects of their desire?
Yeah, it's a whole Judeo-Christian thing. But I wouldn't lay it all at their doorstep. But yeah, I think that's been a major influence in the segregation of the genders and the enforcement of the bipolar gender system, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you take a look at, for example, the Gnostic Gospels, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were very specifically talking about deities that had no gender, very specifically. And you can find passages in there where Jesus is attributed of saying, you know, like, look, it's not a man, it's not a woman, that has nothing to do with it, you know. You're all one in the eyes of the Lord. Well, what is that statement? Why don't we interpret that to mean something of some place we can go? And that's even in the New Testament.
So now, how do you get past the really obvious thing of addressing people as he or she? I imagine that would have to come to an end as well.
Well, yeah, in the same way that feminists as recent as 20 years ago put an end to the salutation miss or missus, depending on a woman's relationship to a man, by introducing a new term called Ms., which has taken 20-some-odd years to get somewhat of a grip in English-speaking world. It's still not fully in, and it's still not fully accepted. I mean, we're going to have to introduce gender-free pronouns. Now, there exists tons of gender-free pronouns, and they're in use all the time on the net and on the web. in a book that Caitlin Sullivan and I wrote called Nearly Roadkill, we use the pronouns Z, Z-E, and here, H-I-R. H-I-R was actually a gender-free pronoun from Middle English. Chaucer's time, they had gender-free pronouns. Isn't that interesting? Yes. So we use Z in here, like Z sat down at her computer and turned it on. Yes, it robs us of knowing, well, what sat down at its computer? We need to know. Why do we need to know? That's a much better question.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is the source of the two-gender system in people's preoccupation with gender? And what do you think is the source of the oppression around it?
All right, this is going to be a little woo-woo here, but I think that as a race, humanity's at a turning point. I think it's a bipolar way of thinking. I think we've divided everything into two. I don't think it's just gender, but gender's the one that's got the foothold. I mean, it's like South Africa says, there are blacks and there are whites. And there are coloreds, two categories, and only two. Well, most of us who have any degree of reason look at that, and we're aghast. We go, how could they? And, we supported Nelson Mandela, and we said, yeah, you go. And we sent him our money, and we sent him our prayers, and some of us, even went over there, and we helped. But when it comes to gender, we're going, oh, well, that's natural. So it's I think the source of the two-gender system is our tendency to think in either or, and either or is on its way out. Computers are based on an either or system. It's on or it's off. It's a binary. It's a binary code. It's a one or a zero. It's an on or an off. Computers are much better at binary thinking than any human. Much, much better. And I think that's a signal that we've developed that. I think that's a signal to the human race that it's time to evolve beyond that and to start thinking in terms of more than two. That's going to take a while. That's going to take centuries. But I think we're beginning to see the inklings of a time when it's actually beginning to develop.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've said a lot already about feminists promoting the idea that biology is not destiny. But at the same time, when I was reading our book, I thought, I could see some feminists having a problem with this, because when you accept that their gender is the source of their oppression and their oppression is then the source of their political and social identity, it would almost seem, when you refer to gender as a playground, it almost seems that it trivializes the oppression that feminists feel. What do you say to that?
I tend to talk in paradoxes. There's this wonderful Zen saying, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. It describes a Zen student's journey into spiritual enlightenment. Beginning Zen student looks at a mountain and goes, look, there's a mountain. Zen teacher says, there's no mountain, everything's all one. The student says, you're crazy, there's a mountain there. And after a lot of study, the Zen student goes, oh my God, everything is all one. It's all the same. It's just like atoms. It's just like, I get it. There's no mountain. And the Zen master goes, you crazy? There's a mountain there. So yes, there's gender. And yes, there's a lot of oppression that's being done in the name of gender. And I think I also make the point in Gender Outlaw that the first front of any gender, true gender revolution, would have to be stopping the violence done in the name of gender, so we get some breathing room so that we can sit around and hash all this stuff out. And the chief violence that's being done in the name of gender right now is the oppression, nearly universal oppression of women. And that has got to be the front fight. So yes, while gender exists as a social construction, there are pockets of us who, while we're fighting that, are learning to play with it. Happens at the same time. It's not an either or.
What property of womanness do you think is actually the source of women's oppression, given that there are so many different characteristics we attribute to gender?
I have to think about that. That's okay. A good question. I don't know. I don't know. There are better, you know, there are people who are women have looked at this a lot more closely than I have. I would say it's the mere fact that they're not men. I would say that anything that is not man is going to be oppressed. And I would say it's the buying into giving man the cultural supremacy that does it. A woman who looks like a man and passes as a man is not going to be as oppressed as a woman who doesn't. Now,
femininity versus masculinity.
Well, now it gets even deeper than that. And this is what I'm talking about in my new book, the Gender Workbook. I come up with a gender pyramid. There's lots of metaphors for gender, and I found one based on the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's food group triangle. I did, I swear. I was eating a box of pretzels one day, and on the side it had this food group triangle. Have you ever seen it?
No.
Oh, it's great. You know, like, it's a triangle, it's a pyramid. And the very bottom, the big bulk at the bottom is like grains and carbohydrates, and that's supposed to be the basis of your diet. Eat a lot of that. And the next two levels up are, fruits and vegetables, and then higher up is meats and dairies, and then at the very top is oils and sugars. Don't eat very much of those. They're not good for you. Well, gender's a lot like that. If we take the height of the pyramid and call that a function of power, and we call the width of the pyramid a function of quantity of people, then all of a sudden we get a better picture of what's gender. And at the very top of the pyramid, we'd have someone who is the perfect gender. Now, what is the perfect gender? Well, yeah, it would certainly have a penis and testicles. But it would also be white. It would also be Christian. It would also be conservatively political. It would also have fathered more of the same. It would also be right-handed. It would also, you know, like all of the different, you know, it would be able-bodied. It would be strong. It would, you know, there are so many modifiers to the perfect gender that I don't think there's anyone that is one. And what we're doing is keeping this in place by our agreement to it. Now, that's happening less and less with all the civil rights groups that are going on. Black civil rights groups saying, no, white is not the privileged class. Differently abled civil rights groups going, no, just because you have a body type like that and I have a body type like this doesn't mean you get all the goodies. Women have been saying it, just because you have a penis and testicles doesn't mean you get all the goodies. So enough of these groups coming together and pooling their resources are going to dethrone that perfect gender. I think the source of it is the fact that we believe in a binary, and no binary can be equal, period. No binary can be equal. So the fact that it's a binary system builds in oppression, builds in inequality. People talk about equal rights. I don't believe in equal rights. I believe in universal rights. And there's a big difference.
Do you think that all of the genders can live together, however many there are, without power imbalances?
Well, this is why I'm so fond of SM. Sadomasochism, bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, play. You know, I'm a member of the leather community, if there is such a thing. I play with this stuff. We play with power. We consensually give power over. Now, it's only recently, let's say in the last couple of thousand years, with the rise of Christianity and Judeo-Christian cultures, let's say the last 6,000 years, that power has not been treated on a consensual basis. I mean, you take the simple example of a group of people getting together, 10 people, and they agree that they're going to pass the talking stick, let's say, and only the person who's holding the stick gets to talk. Well, that's a way of consensually giving power to someone, consensually giving up your power, knowing that, and trusting, trust is a big factor of this, that you're going to get your turn, and that you're going to have your voice. It's going to take a while to get over the distrust we've built up over, you know, however many millennia that we've been believing in this bipolar system. It's going to take a great deal of time to get over that mistrust. But I think if we start acting that way amongst ourselves as outlaws, as people who transgress gender, as people who disobey the gender rules, whatever the gender rules might be, and we start trusting each other, lesbians trusting gays, gays trusting transgenders, transgenders trusting lesbians, all of us trusting intersex people, all of us trusting SM players, sex workers, and going, okay, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt here. That's all we have to say. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. That's his first step.
So if gender is a construct and it's a playground, what happens to sexual orientation?
It goes right down the tubes. I mean, when it's, it does. I mean, you know, like, that's the biggest gripe that, fear or gripe that I can see that, you know, a lesbian movement or a gay male movement would have with a transgender movement, is that by acknowledging that a transgender movement exists or that transgender people exist, you're wiping out the basis of your sexual orientation. Get over it. That's happening.
What property of maleness or femaleness do you think people are attracted to when you think that, when they call themselves gay or straight or whatever?
I don't know. You'd have to ask someone who calls themselves gay or straight. I have no idea. I think it's kind of narrow-minded myself. Now, I have preferences. I certainly have preferences. I mean, I prefer sexually people who define more toward the woman aspect of things. But there have been some men I've been really sexually attracted to, but not romantically. And then you get a difference of romance and sexuality, and that has, and love, and that has a lot to do with trust. And I've got my own inherent fears of being oppressed, and having been oppressed, and having been raped, and having been hit. It's not easy for me to trust people who define rigidly as men. But that's just a factor in my sexual orientation. I think as the world gets gentler, and the trust begins to grow, then that wouldn't be a factor in my sexual orientation. But safety is a big part of it. I've been pretty unsafe, and so I find that, you know, like, well, who can I be safe with? Who can I trust with my heart? That's a big factor in sexuality, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we diversify or eliminate gender categories, does that take away from the oppression that gays experience, do you think?
It will, of course. It'll take away from the oppression that anybody who's a gender outlaw, and I would include gays and lesbians and intersexed and SM players and sex workers and feminists. I mean, the early feminists, the very early feminists, let's say, on this continent in North America, when they started wearing pants, they were accused of not being women. They still are. You know, the Phyllis Schlafly's of the world are saying, you're not a real woman. A real woman makes her husband dinner. You know? Excuse me? You know, so you're already being accused of a lesbian. How often have you heard, you're not a real woman until you've had a man? Look at what those words are saying. You're not a real woman until you've had a man. We all have our hidden bases for gender categorization, and sexuality based on the gender of one's partner is a major one. Heterosexuality would be a factor in the perfect gender as well. The perfect gendered person would be heterosexual because it would hold in place that bipolar system.
So what happens to the battle for same-sex benefits, same-sex parenting, same-sex rights if rigid gender categorization no longer exists?
You're saying the word sex, and I would say the word gender. So same gender rights, same gender privileges, same gender stuff. It's just, it gets back down. Same, I mean, who's the same gender as me? I don't know anybody. Who's the same gender as you? What are the qualifications of your gender? I don't know anybody who's the same gender as you. We're going to have to drop words like same and equal and opt for words like universal. Mm-hmm. Universal rights, universal privilege, universal access, universal economic stability, universal right to health care, universal right to safety on the streets. there's no backing away from this. The, you know, Pandora's box was opened when the first person who was excluded said, I won't be excluded. And we're just furthering that. And we have to get to a point where it is universal. We cannot afford to use words like same or equal anymore. Time for that is over.
So what happens to the institution of marriage?
Oh, I don't know. If two people love each other and want to, you know, commit to that and get that, you know, in the eyes of the law for whatever reason, or the eyes of the church for whatever reason, I suppose they could. I mean, I was involved in a relationship for 3 years. 3 years into the relationship, we decided we're going to have a commitment ceremony. And we said, oh, cool, this is going to be great. We did all the woo-woo things. We burnt the incense. We lit the candles. We said the spells, you know. We had our friends there, and it was great. And we felt, oh, wonderful. For the next month, life was hell. Because what we had done was put our relationship, put the responsibility for our relationship onto the commitment ceremony, onto the fact that we were committed, rather than living it day by day. So we undid the commitment ceremony and got along fine after that.
That's interesting.
Well, you know, like marriage implies, when we hear the word marriage, we think of two and two only people. I've been involved in triads, where it was, essentially a marriage of three people. Marriage implies monogamy, monofidelity. Why? Sure, there are some people who have an inclination toward that, but what is the nature of the inclination? What are the factors that comprise that inclination toward monogamy? Are you just going to accept that, oh, I'm monogamous? Oh, are you really? You've never been attracted to someone outside of your relationship? I doubt it. You know, you might say, well, I'm definitely, faithful. Well, at what cost? I don't know what lies beyond this. I think we're opening, a box that only our great-great-great-great-grandchildren are going to reap the benefits from.
So just out of curiosity, what do you say to other transgendered people who say, hey, wait a second. I just went through surgery, did hormones, spent a whole ton of money becoming a woman, and now you're saying, well, gender is just a playground. It's a social construct, whatever, That's invalidating my identity. That's invalidating what I went through. How do you respond to that?
I would first say to this person, I would validate their bravery and their courage for bucking a system that says you can't change your gender. And I would say that the courage to do that makes this person very dear to me. Makes you very, very dear to me. It makes me want to just put my arms around you and go, oh, baby. And now it's time for the next step.
So what kind of strategies do you think that the feminist movement, the gay movement, the transgender movement, the intersex movement, etc., need to focus on in order to win our respective rights, but also to maybe better benefit what each other is trying to accomplish in the process?
I think the focus has to be on coalition building. I mean, people have been saying this forever. Shivad is going around the world saying this, and I think this is exactly what needs to happen. Bernice Johnson Regan has been saying this forever as well. We need to focus our energy on stopping the violence. We need to find out who is being the most oppressed and help them first. And right now, the most oppressed are women, blacks, differently abled people, differently... I have no idea what the politically correct word is for someone, who might be autistic, who might be manic depressive. These are people who are heavily, heavily, heavily oppressed. I mean, yeah, we're oppressed. Yeah, I'm oppressed. But not, in terms of having my livelihood taken away from me. Not in terms of being homeless. You know, I can make a living. I do, you know, either phone sex or telemarketing, you know, when my writing, you know, isn't going that well. But, you know, I can do that. There are people who can't, and those are the people that all of these civil rights groups you mentioned need to get together and go, okay, we're going to all get behind this and help these people now and stop the violence, stop the harming. We have to have a goal of harmlessness. And whatever reason the harm is being done. And this is why I think one of the first strategies would have to be giving up an identity politic. Identity politics has been necessary, I think, over the past, you know, 40, 50, or 100 years, because there hasn't been the opportunity for communication amongst peoples. Now there is. Now there's no need for identity politics. We need to develop a politic that's based on value, that's based on compassion, that's based on a common desire to stop the harm that's going on in the culture. Just the harm that's being done to people. And we have to look at ourselves and go, well, yeah, I'm being harmed, but look at that person over there. They need their help more than I do, than I need help. And we have to just kind of tighten our belts and go over and do and help that person.
Thanks a lot. Okay.
This doing away with identity politics would include transgender. I'm dismayed right now to see the transgender movement coalescing around a transgender identity. I think that to me is extremely sad. I won't belong to that movement. I do not claim part of that movement. I don't call myself a transgender activist anymore. I'm an activist, and I'm an activist to stop the harm that's going on in the world. But I would not call myself a transgender activist, or I wouldn't call myself a Jewish activist. I wouldn't call myself, you know, anything other than a person who's trying to stop the harm that's going on in the world. And I would really, really hope that the direction of this transgender movement gets over themselves quickly enough to embrace every other movement and to reach out and go, okay, yeah, we're all getting hurt here. Who needs our help first?
Great.